Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for staying tuned to this rough news about our fragile climate. We continue with Dr. Morgan Schaller from Rutgers University on his new paper about the record of rapid climate change. Morgan Schaller, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on here.
Well, it's good that you called. Thank you. Let's start with this. Briefly, what is the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum, or PETM?
So this is an event at the Paleocene-Eocene boundary, which is just a geologic boundary that corresponds to a massive increase in atmospheric CO2, along with about a 5°C global warming. And it really wasn't very well understood how fast this thing occurred, but I think we put some numbers on it now in this new paper.
So how would you characterize the importance of the discovery made by your team?
It's definitely very important to this particular, to the circumstances of this particular event, and it definitely has implications for what we're doing today and maybe the rate of carbon release that we're doing today.
Well, how did you and James Wright uncover this ancient heat signal?
These are a series of sediment cores where we made this discovery, and these are basically long cylinders of muds and silts from the coastal plain, on the Atlantic coastal plain. And Jim Wright was helping a colleague process these cores, split them in their two halves. And what he noticed was that there were these really remarkably rhythmic couplets in this particular clay unit that contains this PETM event, this massive carbon perturbation event. And when he sort of called me over and showed them to me, I said, you know, really, these have got to mean something. And as geologists, whenever we see features like that, we sort of start looking for mechanisms that can account for them. And in this case, we made some oxygen isotope measurements that tell you something about temperature changes. And we found that in the stuff preserved within each one of these little clay cycles, about 2 centimeter thick clay cycles, there was a temperature cycle associated with each one. And for a variety of reasons, we concluded that each clay couplet represents an annual depositional cycle. So if these cycles are due to the seasonal climate cycle on the continental shelf, then the carbon isotope excursion and that's that massive release of CO2 to the atmosphere that is recorded by those sediments, we now have a very accurate timescale through the release of that carbon. So, and what we found was that the CO2 was released nearly instantaneously, appears to be within one of these clay couplets, or about 1 year. And then over a series of about a decade, the surface waters, the ocean surface waters went acidic, and there was about a 5°C warming.
And you calculated, it says, that it would take about 3,000 gigatons of carbon to create this massive heating event. That sounds close to what I've seen as the mass of carbon in the atmosphere right now. What could have caused such a huge, fast carbon burst?
The mass of carbon that was really roughly about 3,000 gigatons. And at the time, there would have been about 2,000 gigatons in the atmosphere. Our atmosphere today has about 800 gigatons of carbon, a little bit less than that. So they are a little bit different. But the possible triggers for this event in the Paleocene, I mean, there have been a whole lot of causes sort of tossed out there. But as it stands, the very best explanation for this carbon release is a comet impact. And there is some evidence in these sediments and other places that there was, in fact, some kind of impact at this time.
It had to happen really, really fast for what you found, yeah.
Yeah, and we can exclude things like methane that has something like a 10-year residence time in the atmosphere, things like that.
And what do we know about what happened on Earth during and immediately after such a steep temperature change? Were there extinctions, changes in ecosystems, changes in the oceans? Do we know what happened?
We have a fairly good idea of, I mean, sort of the global picture of what happened after this event. I mean, we know that at least in the oceans, there was about a 5°C change in temperature, increase in temperature, and that was most certainly global. But there were no really significant extinctions. Some bottom water living organisms had a tough time, but that's about it. But after this massive release of carbon, there is evidence for acidification of the oceans, and there's evidence from ocean sediments and from a variety of other means that there was an acidification coincident with the global warming. And we do know that there were changes in temperature and humidity on land, specifically in the continental interiors. Things seemed to get drier, and maybe on the coast, things got a lot wetter. some of those specific effects are not very clear.
I did read one article that the Smithsonian was doing research in Wyoming where they found that plants had moved up, so that they had plants there that you might have found in a South Carolina swamp for a while after this PETM event.
Right. And they moved up. I think they moved both northward and up in altitude. Presumably that is a response to an increase in temperature. So there are some pretty clear responses to things on land during this time. We know that there was a significant aridification. And that's a great section out in Wyoming that shows some of the best evidence of changes on land concurrent with this event.
Well, let's talk about how this Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum carbon release would compare to what humans are emitting now. Can you tell us that?
Sure. What we're doing now, well, first, what we found is that the carbon release at this event was much faster than what we're doing now. Previous estimates on the rates really were all over the place and not very precise. And for that reason, it was used as an analog for what we're doing today. But what we've shown is that it was much faster than what we're doing today by a long shot. But a not insignificant finding is that we've really confirmed that there is a positive temperature response to a CO2 release. And what we've done, what happened in this event was something like a 2.5 times increase in CO2 in the atmosphere. So, you know, a little bit over a doubling, maybe a doubling and a half, which resulted in about 5 degrees C of global warming. And that's been demonstrated numerous times. We've done a good job confirming that this massive release, a single release, did coincide with a big increase in temperature, which is significant. But with a single fast release scenario like this, it actually makes things quite simple to understand. And that's because we've added the carbon to the atmosphere in an almost instantaneous way, whereas what we're doing now is extremely slow. Well, not extremely slow, but relatively slow compared to an instantaneous perturbation. I was searching for the right analogy for this, why this might be significant, but you can think of this like a little kid jumping in a mud puddle. If he jumps directly into the water, all the water goes flying out of the mud puddle, and if he hops out immediately, he doesn't get very wet. However, if he sort of walks slowly into the mud puddle, all the water has time to absorb into his shoes and his socks and soak up his pant legs, and he'll get completely drenched. So what we're doing now is releasing carbon at a rate of something like 8 gigatons per year, which is equivalent to walking very slowly into that puddle. If we compare that to the PETM, we were releasing something like 3,000 gigatons almost within 1 year. So very different rates.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking about new science on a rapid warming of the Earth 55 million years ago and what it might mean for our future. Our guest is Dr. Morgan Schaller from Rutgers University. Well, the Earth was a different place at that time. The continents were different. Antarctica, I believe, was attached to South America, was it not? So could you talk a little bit more about the similarities and differences from those times to now?
Sure. I think one of the biggest differences between then and now, at least from a climate perspective, was that now we have a substantial amount of ice on the continents, you know, Greenland, Antarctica, whereas during the Eocene, this is 56 million years ago, there was hardly any ice on the continents at all. So that in itself makes the response of the climate system to any kind of perturbation very different. So, for example, if we were to release this amount of carbon that we're suggesting happened at the PETM within a year now, we would probably see a pretty dramatic response from the ice sheets, an increase in sea level and that kind of thing. Whereas during the Eocene, that effect would not have been in place. And there are other things along those lines that are a little bit different. Continental configurations were obviously a little bit different. Ocean circulation was a little bit different. But by and large, things were actually pretty similar to what they are today. It was just substantially warmer on land and in the oceans overall before the event.
So the ice, I would think, would act a little bit like a set of brakes on a car compared to what they had then. Would I be right in that?
Sort of. The ice would be a big player, for sure. Ice causes changes in the climate system that, like albedo and things like that, that is reflecting coming radiation back out to space that would not have been in play during the PETM. So there are some estimates that say at the PETM, we would actually expect to see a little bit more warming per doubling of CO2 than we would observe now because of the reflectance that the ice sheets are causing during current times. But the analogy is a little bit more difficult because this was released so quickly at this event.
For this new paper, you had Wallace Broker, Wally Broker, the person who popularized the term global warming, as the editor. How was it working with the man called the Dean of Climate Science?
I mean, he's a great guy and really, really has an eye for separating those truly significant observations from the less meaningful ones. When we gave this talk at Columbia, he immediately recognized the potential significance of these findings, which was really sort of a breath of fresh air because it's met some resistance from some people that are a little more entrenched in a different way of thinking. And he also sort of immediately recognized that this piece of work needed to be evaluated in peer review by highly qualified people who simply have no career investment in this event to remove the possibility of bias, which was really, that was an amazing extension of himself there.
Is that talk at Columbia available anywhere online, or was it recorded?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay. Now, Morgan Schaller, what are other scientists saying about this discovery? Have doubts been expressed?
Sure, and there will always be skepticism, and I take that as a very good thing. It's healthy, and I would be concerned if there was no skepticism around our findings. But really, the most people without any attachment to this event, you know, that haven't spent a significant amount of their career looking at this thing, see our results as sort of a breath of fresh air. Now we can start to learn some more things from what happened 55 million years ago. And most of the real vocal people against this idea, or at least that express severe doubts about this finding, have sort of an academic career investment in other scenarios.
Well, one of my concerns would be climate models. I wonder if they could pick up such a rapid event in the past, and if not, could they pick up a rapid climate shift in the future? So are these climate theories and models going to have to be adjusted, do you think?
Two things actually in there. First of all, I don't think any climate model would ever be able to predict this event. If it indeed was due to a comet, which, you know, that certainly has not been settled. But if that were the case, a climate model would never be able to predict something like that. And I don't think that any model would be able to predict such a rapid change using normal climate dynamics ever. But if you prescribe such a rapid change, the models do a very good job of describing the response of each individual system to that increase in CO2. And what we've done in this paper actually, it really helps out some of those models because now they have a very precise timescale of the carbon released. So whereas before they had to use a range of timescales and it was really unclear how fast this event happened. But there's a lot of work with these models that show pretty convincingly that there's a 100,000 year sort of fall off response to, or 200,000 year or so fall off response of this CO2 perturbation working its way through all of Earth's exchangeable carbon reservoirs. And a lot of that science is going to remain basically unchanged. If anything, it'll be much more precise now that we know exactly how quickly this thing happened.
Morgan, will you be doing follow-up research, and are you working on a new project?
Oh, I've got several things going on now, but I'm looking at the next kind of thing on the docket is to look at ocean acidification as recorded by corals. And specifically, I'm going to be looking at what's happening at this event. Across a couple coral sequences. Corals are surface water animals that also have a photosynthetic guy living with them, and they show very profound responses to ocean acidification as well as ocean warming. So it would be really interesting to get a good handle on the exact chemical ocean chemistry changes that are recorded within corals that survive through this event. That's one direction I'm really pushing hard on right now.
What is the takeaway for listeners about what this discovery says about the possibility of a rapid climate shift triggered by our own emissions?
Well, in some ways, this event has always been an imperfect analogy to what we're doing now. Certainly, if a rapid release of carbon, like the scenario for the PETM, were to happen today, the consequences would be very different. Like I mentioned, there would probably be a very profound response from the glaciers and from ice sheets, which means there would probably be a pretty rapid increase in sea levels and things like that. But in the Eocene, there was no substantial ice on land, so we don't really have an analogy for those effects. But what we have done is shown that there is an unequivocal temperature response to a little over a doubling of atmospheric CO2. And we've added a very precise timescale to those observations. So So like I said, the PTM was much faster, and what we're doing now is about 8 gigatons of carbon per year versus at the PTM, you know, we're looking at something like 3,000 gigatons per year. So I think there are a lot of things we can learn from this event that are potentially in our future, but I think what we're doing right now may in some ways be a little more dangerous because we're releasing carbon at such a rate that all those slower acting carbon reservoirs exchange on much longer timescales. We're releasing carbon so that those reservoirs can become active and absorb this perturbation that we're creating in a much more equilibrium way. So that we're sort of fundamentally shifting our climate state, whereas at the PETM, we basically immediately perturbed an already equilibrium climate state, which is a very different thing. So if we go back to the analogy of a kid jumping in a puddle, what we're doing right now is essentially as if we were walking very slowly into that puddle and the water is able to absorb into all of the active water absorbing reservoirs on our body, which would be analogous to those carbon reservoirs. Whereas if we do this thing extremely quickly, like we're suggesting nearly instantaneously as happened at the PETM, it has much less long-term permanent effects, at least I would argue.
You've been listening to Dr. Morgan F. Schaller from the Wright Labs at Rutgers University in New Jersey. We've been discussing his new co-authored paper, Evidence for a Rapid Release of Carbon at the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum. It reveals a rapid increase in global temperature in just 13 years. Morgan, thank you for contributing your work and time to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You've heard a lot of news about protests in the Arctic. People have been protesting the fact that the Russians are going up with one of the first drilling rigs to grab some more fossil fuels out of the Arctic and make even more ice melt. We have on the line Stephanie Goodwin. She's the BC director for Greenpeace Canada. She's been very active on this file. I met her on the Rainbow Warrior a few nights ago. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you.
So let's get an update. What is happening now with, and how many people are there in this protest?
So we originally had almost, well, a month ago today, four protesters that were trying to get on to Gazprom's oil rig in order to peacefully protest fossil fuel extraction from the Arctic. And what ended up happening was those activists that were trying to get up on the oil rig were arrested, as well as everyone else involved and everyone on board our ship. And that means that there were 28 activists, including, and then a videographer and a photographer, who were all arrested at gunpoint by the Russian military and taken to police detention while they towed our ship to port.
This did happen once before in the early 1990s. Then it was the KGB who dragged a Greenpeace ship in. The protest was against the dumping of nuclear reactors at Nova Zemlya up in the Arctic. Eventually, the ship was released and the crew. What is going on now diplomatically? Are the Canadian government getting involved in any way?
Well, our ship, she's called the Arctic Sunrise. She has been seized by the Russian government, and it flies under a Dutch flag. So the Dutch government is following the appropriate channels to intervene with the Russian government to have that ship released. And then in terms of the activists themselves, they are currently under charge of piracy right now, and they are being detained for 2 months while the Russian government conducts an investigation into very, very serious charges of piracy, which our analysis is that it doesn't hold up. That kind of charge does not hold up under Russian or international law, which, you know, Vladimir Putin agrees with us in certain respects on that. And some of the interesting things that have been happening over the last couple of days, because we've been trying to garner as much international support for this as possible, is a few days ago, Hillary Clinton said, while she was in England, that she doesn't understand why there isn't already more international outcry toward the Russian government's treatment of these activists and charging them with piracy. And then just yesterday, a number of Nobel Peace laureates collectively wrote a letter, and that includes Desmond Tutu from South Africa, wrote a letter to Vladimir Putin in support of the Arctic 30 and asking for their release. We're not saying that our Arctic 30 aren't willing to face the consequences of their actions. However, we believe in facing reasonable consequences for our reasonable, peaceful actions.
And my understanding is this rig doesn't move. So piracy, you usually think of boarding a ship and taking it over. This is hardly a ship. Can you describe the rig itself?
It's a large oil drilling rig in the Arctic. It's not exactly the same, but if you were to imagine what people can best identify with is if you were to imagine some of the oil rigs a few years ago from the Gulf of Mexico with the BP oil spill. While not exactly similar, you know, it's a rig that looks in some ways in the same ball field as that. And our activists had done this previously. We were just going to board the oil rig and peacefully protest in order to gain attention and to stop the oil drilling so that we could stop the drilling in the Arctic, stop resource extraction in the Arctic so that we can actually start moving in the right direction towards mitigating climate change.
And I believe Greenpeace put out a report suggesting how much greenhouse gases could come out if we go ahead and drill Arctic resources. Do you know about that report?
Well, what we do have is we have an Energy Revolution report, which talks about the degree to which the globe, as well as the Canadians, can get off of fossil fuels and how we can do that over, you know, over a period of time, over the next 50 years. And what we're not saying that we're going to eliminate all fossil fuel use over the next 50 years, but we can significantly reduce it so that the kinds of fossil fuels that we'll be using won't include the dirtiest, most dangerous, most expensive kinds, which are Arctic oil drilling, offshore oil and gas drilling, the deep sea stuff, the Alberta tar sands. Those are the most expensive, the most dangerous, and the dirtiest when you consider the full life cycle of the fossil fuel that's being extracted and used at the consumer end.
And one of my concerns, and I'm sure the concerns of millions of people, is what happens if there's a spill up there in the winter? There's no way they're going to be able to clean anything up, is there?
Well, what I know is a few years ago, during the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, I went down to do an on-the-ground investigation. And some of the things I learned were that it's very difficult to clean up an oil spill. Some of the methods that are most pervasively used in cleaning up oil spills are very, very rudimentary. You know, the use of oil booms and that being a primary way of being able to clean up oil is just simply not an effective tool if it doesn't have a whole complement of other tools that can be used. And what I learned down there was that companies consider it a professional success if after an oil spill they're able to clean up 15% of the oil that's spilled. That's 15%. And so when we think about something like the Arctic region, a place that has very little infrastructure, very little support, I would imagine that success rate for cleanup after an oil spill would be reduced further. And what we know is that there are so many unpredictable variables when it comes to an oil spilling from an offshore oil rig, particularly one in the Arctic, that it quite frankly scares me, the idea that we could potentially be facing an oil spill.
And again, in the Gulf of Mexico, they said a lot of the oil disappeared because there were oil-eating bacteria in those warm waters. Those aren't going to be found in any sort of numbers in the Arctic waters, I wouldn't think.
Well, and in the Gulf of Mexico during that oil spill, one of the things that the government and BP made heavy use of was dispersants, which is a chemical compound that when you put it into the water, it interacts with spilled oil products, and it causes the spilled oil to fall to the floor of the sea. It doesn't actually dissolve or disperse the oil. All it does is it makes it disappear from the surface so that, A, you're not seeing it on the surface, and B, so that it's not hitting landfall, because once it hits landfall, it's more difficult for a company to clean up. However, that doesn't tell us anything about what might be happening on the bottom of the ocean today.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, speaking with Stephanie Goodwin from Greenpeace Canada. And I want to bring out the point, too, that there are a couple of Americans on board, are there?
There are an American on board. There are two Canadians on board as well. Yeah, their nationalities represented, you know, from all over the world. Our crews are notoriously from all over the world. One of our crew, which is the captain, Peter Wilcox, has been sailing Greenpeace ships for decades and was actually the captain of the ship when it was seized by the KGB in the 1990s. And then as well was also on the ship on the very first Rainbow Warrior in 1985 when it was bombed by the French Secret Service. And one of our photographers lost their lives. So he's had quite a bit of experience with dealing with governments who have irrational and or with reactions that are disproportionate to the situation.
I ask that because, you know, if somebody grabs an American in the streets of Iran, we hear about it every day on the front pages. It's good that Hillary Clinton has spoken up, but there could be a lot more to be said by all of these countries about their nationals being grabbed. Was that ship in international waters?
Well, the ship was in international waters when it was seized, so that, according to our legal team and legal analysis, is illegal to be seizing a ship in international waters. And my understanding is that, you know, different crew members have had their various governments making diplomatic overtures to the Russian government in order to get their folks released and apply the appropriate amount of pressure. Because it's important for us to remember that our issue is not necessarily with the police. Our issue isn't necessarily with the Russian government. Our issue is with protecting the Arctic. And what we have to remember is that our primary purpose is to protect the Arctic so that space can be kept a healthy and safe ecosystem and provide its maximum contribution to stopping a runaway climate change. And so for us, it's how do we continue to campaign and not stop what we're doing in the face of the kind of absurd charges that we're seeing coming towards the Arctic 30.
And the executive director of Greenpeace International made a very brave proposal, I thought. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Our international executive director, Kumi Naidu, South African man, has sent a letter to Vladimir Putin requesting the release of the 30 detainees and offering as a guarantee that those 30 activists would return for trial. He offered himself. He offered to go and live in Russia himself while the Russian government conducts their investigation and readies themselves for trial. So he's willing to put himself on the line in order so that others can be free today.
What sort of conditions are these people being held in the Arctic 30? Are they in a common Russian jail?
They're being held in a Russian jail. Their conditions vary, but they are receiving, you know, relatively healthy conditions, although details differ depending on who the detainees are, and I don't have specifics on those.
Okay, and the real point behind all this is that this is just early days in this whole Arctic drilling thing. I know Kumi Naidu was involved in an actual action off of Greenland trying to stop Arctic drilling. The Canadians are hot to trot to get out there. It's going to be a worldwide rush. China's interested. We just can't have this happen. First, the oil industry melts all the ice, and now they want to go in and melt the rest of it.
Yeah, what we know is that we're in it for the long game. We don't think that there is a moment to lose. We don't have a moment to lose in terms of fighting to save our planet, and the urgency couldn't be higher at this point. So for us, we are doing everything we can to get our Arctic 30 out of jail, but not stop our campaigning at all on trying to stop runaway climate change and trying to protect the Arctic. Because what we know now is that the link between democracy and the environmental struggle couldn't be closer. And so everything that we do to protect the Arctic is about being able to generate not just protection for the Arctic, but also opening up that democratic space, because it's through a healthy, robust arena for debate, disagreement, and protest that we can actually arrive at creative solutions to environmental problems that everyone can sign on to. For us, the struggle for both remains really, really clear and really urgent, and we're not stopping either.
Well, Stephanie Goodwin, we have listeners around the world. What can they do to help free the Arctic 30?
Anybody who is concerned about the Arctic 30 and wants to help out can visit our website. You can go to greenpeace.org, and you can go to your relevant country website, and there'll be a take action page, and there are also other opportunities that'll be listed on the webpage as well for communicating with our detainees and for taking action in your own home community. What we know is that today there are a number of actions happening around the world to mark the 1 month anniversary that our activists have been in detention today.
We've been talking with Stephanie Goodwin from Greenpeace Canada. Thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks very much.
Get links to follow up on today's interviews in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Find out how to support this program at our website, ecoshock.org. We are out of time. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Smith.